This is Bob Lang, oral historian on Thursday, February 28th, 2013. This is the second interview session with Emeritus Professor Edward R. Hasselkus, and we are discussing a continuing discussion of his career and his work at the Arboretum. Ed, we got through the first session on Monday without my asking you about your personal life here, your marriage, children, and the impact that they had on your life and career here in Madison.
Betty Rasteen and I were married June 1960 in her hometown of Baraboo, Wisconsin. She got her undergraduate degree in occupational therapy on one Saturday, and we were married the following Saturday. Fortunately, her mother was very good at arranging weddings, because her sister, Betty's sister, had been married the previous fall, and so she was well rehearsed. Betty got her bachelor's degree in occupational therapy and has been involved in her field ever since. And I'll say a little bit more about that. We have two children, Jane and John. They were both born here in Madison in the old university hospitals. And the doctor who brought Betty into the world brought them into the world as well, Dr. Madeline Thornton. And curiously, then, when Betty was on the faculty, she was almost in the same office where she gave birth to the kids. So our children went to Randall School and ultimately to West High. I guess we never even discussed their going elsewhere to college. And so they both chose that route. And
meaning they came to the
UW. They came to UW, and our agreement was that they didn't have to live at home. And they did not. Jane started out actually in chemical engineering. And I think it was within the first week of classes or something like that, she suddenly decided that this wasn't right. So she switched to biochemistry and got her bachelor's degree in biochemistry. And she got a job at the Forest Products Laboratory as a researcher. And stayed there, I think it was 2 years. And in our my talking with Jane, Jane is a very social creature. And her life with two other people in a lab just wasn't particularly right for her. So she decided to get her MBA. So she got her MBA here. And her first job was with Kodak in Rochester. She has been there ever since. She remained with Kodak for probably, I would say, about 15 years. And her division was, she was working in the in marketing in the medical imaging field. Her division got bought from Kodak. So she remained there for a short while and then decided to make a change. She was with Johnson & Johnson also for a couple of years. She is now head of worldwide marketing for Cooper Vision, which is contact lenses. And being worldwide marketing director, she does a lot of travel. And she has friends in every port. So Jane has not had children. She is married. And her husband is from Rochester, and so chances are that's where they're going to remain. And so we do get together regularly, and Jane is a delight to have as a daughter.
I just have to suggest that in view of who you are, her gregariousness, she might come by honestly, would you say?
I think she got it mainly from her mother, however.
Oh. Okay, well, I've not met her.
All right. Our son, John, 3 years younger than Jane, he got his degree in electrical and computer engineering with a double major in computer science. And as soon as he graduated, he took a job with a company in Maryland. I'm not sure I can remember the name of it at the moment. However, while he was there with this company, he had the opportunity to go on for his master's degree while working. So he got his master's degree out there. And then, to the company was so good to him, he and three employees quit their job and started a new company. The new company, Betty and I invested in, and took off very successfully. And so, he is a multimillionaire, I'm sure.
What was the nature of the business?
The business is the name of it is. Let me think a minute. I may have to amend this. In any case, it's computer systems.
Oh, I see.
Where he worked originally was Telecommunications Technics Corporation. And he got his master's degree at Johns Hopkins. And the new company was, I just can't say it at the moment. In any case, the company got sold. He was the only one of the founders who, the other founders retired in their 30s. He stayed with the company when it was sold. He was the chief software engineer for years, but working out of his home here in Madison.
Oh, really?
And still does.
Huh.
I can't tell you what he does or how he does it. But we visited their company at one time. There's no one over 30 years old. They were all wearing shorts and t-shirts and flip-flops, and so it was an interesting place. John is here in they wanted to be near family. My daughter-in-law is from Madison as well. So John and Sarah have two daughters, Carolyn, who is now 16, and Julia, who is 10. And we're so lucky to have them nearby, and we see them regularly.
That's nice.
And so both of our children have turned out wonderfully, I must say.
I would agree.
And so then I should get back to Betty. From day one after we were married, Betty worked in her field. I used to kid her for a while. She had a job at the Monroe Clinic in Monroe one Saturday a month with vacation in August. So she had her finger in the field. Then when the kids were in school, she went back and got her master's degree. And she got that in the School of Education, and continued to work in her field after that. She was into home health care for much of that time. Then when the kids were in college, she went back to work on her PhD. And so I was paying tuition for three people at the same time. And Betty got her PhD in continuing an adult vocational agriculture, actually. Then she joined the faculty as an assistant professor in occupational therapy. She rose rapidly to full professor. She is an incredible writer, which runs definitely in her family. Her father wrote seven books, and other members of the family were writers. Her sister got her PhD in English and was a poet. Her brother was with Scott Forsman, publishing company. In any case, she has an incredible record of publications. And then toward the end of her career, see, I had retired while she was still working, and so she actually retired at 60. But I think it was after that that she became the editor of the American Journal of Occupational Therapy.
Oh, my God.
And because of that, every occupational therapist in the world knows who she is. So she has been invited to speak all over. Next week, she's going to be speaking in North Carolina. She wrote a book. Yes, the title is The Meaning of Everyday Occupation. It made a big hit. She's done a second edition. And so much of what she talks about now is related to her book. It's used as a textbook a lot. And she also has been invited as an external examiner on PhD programs in Australia, New Zealand, in various European countries. And so she's been a busy person. And so she too, like our daughter, has friends in every port.
Did you enjoy the fact that you and your wife were on the faculty?
Yes, I think so. And of course, our kids grew up with two parents with their noses in books all the time, or in working on papers and things. And mm-hmm. So they, I guess, came by it naturally.
I feel like I should do an oral history interview.
She deserves one, really. Yes.
I'm assuming that the two of you met at the university?
Betty likes to tell this better than I do, but no. I was attending Press House on campus. That was when I was a graduate student, actually. And here's this lovely alto singing in the choir. And I knew the choir director, so I had a word with her. I said, "Who is that?" So I called her. And she knew my name because her roommate was interested in me, of all things. So anyway, that's how it happened.
Well, that's great.
So I was a graduate student, and she was a newly graduated undergrad when we married.
What is of interest to me, looking at this objectively, is you both are Wisconsin natives. You both grew up in the state. You grew up in not in the major urban area.
No.
And you came to the university, and you pursued your graduate education and then your careers here.
Yes, we both had the same, exactly the same pattern, really.
And it's very interesting. I can't recall a single other interview that has that particular journey. It's really,
yes,
it's interesting.
And for both of us.
Yes.
Also.
That's what I mean. Well, thank you for that.
All right.
It's an important part of the record. Now, Ed, I wanted to spend some time on your career as a teacher, reviewing your primary courses, what they were, what they consisted of, and how they changed over the years. As part of that, as you go along, I'd be interested in any further elaboration you can give on how the student body here changed in the course of your career. You alluded to that on Monday, but I have to think that there are other changes too that should be noted. And then when you're talking about the courses, if you would talk about exactly how you use the Arboretum as a resource for those courses. But you were telling me on the way in that you have now remembered the name of your botany professor that was nameless on Monday.
Yeah, Herbert Clark. And that was for Botany 1. That was my favorite course when I was a freshman, as I said. Mm-hmm. And I later on took another course from him, I think it was dendrology, and I got to know him well. And so I knew him as Herbie after that. And I can remember being invited out to his place on Rocky Dell Road, which is out west of Middleton.
Oh.
That was my first encounter, really, of course, with botany at that time. Now, back to my teaching. Remember that before I actually had my PhD, I was asked to teach plant propagation.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was an attempt to lighten the load of Bill Longenecker at the time. And so, and I ended up teaching it for 7 years. And at that point, the department felt they ought to lighten my load, because I'll get into the other courses I was teaching. And so Mac Dana, a colleague in my department, I was probably felt closest to him of anybody after the Longenecker years. And Mac was the kind of person, sure, I'll do it. And he did. And I can remember Mac, when we were dealing with salary raises, Mac got up and said, "Let's not reward the fat cats, but let's think about the younger faculty." I'll never forget him saying that. And he was a Vermonter, and was just a very nice, genuine person. I always liked him so much, and of all things, I had his son as a student later on.
What was his area?
Mac was in fruits, especially cranberries, which turned out is a huge industry in Wisconsin. So the plant propagation, I always thoroughly enjoyed the teaching, but the two courses that I really had a major commitment to, mainly because all students in landscape architecture were required to take it, and most of the students in horticulture, and it was open to other students. And interestingly, in some of my courses, the best student was an art major, curiously.
Did that happen more than once?
It did, actually, yes. So I taught two courses in what were called landscape plants. So it was mainly identification and use of trees, shrubs, and vines. There's a first semester and a second semester. The second semester was simply a continuation of the first. In the fall, as long as we could be outside, which generally was up till when students left for Thanksgiving. All my classes were outside.
Each session?
Every session. Rain or shine, essentially. Although, once in a while, it was storming. I was prepared for a lecture. That was either outside on campus or out here. Generally speaking, I tried to come, this is a two-credit course, met twice, 2 hours each time. And so one of the times I tried to meet out here. Because the resources of plants on campus kept diminishing. And out here I had control, and so I had more and more and more plants that I could use out here.
Why was that happening on campus?
Buildings. You know, between the time I arrived on campus and the time I retired, the square footage of the landscape must have been cut in half or more.
Really?
All these new buildings, parking lots, had the campus changed incredibly in this time. And of course, before I started teaching, Bill Longenecker was in charge of all campus plantings. And so he planted the kinds of things that he thought were important for his teaching. And so they were there for me. I must also say that Bill Longenecker was a great photographer. He had an enormous slide collection, which he made available to me for my teaching. In fact, his earliest were glass plates that he had hand-colored. So they were black and white, but he had hand-colored them. Those I donated to the archives. You can go and find them.
I was going to say, where are they now?
Yeah, they are. They should be. They should be at Steenbach, presumably.
Good.
And including the projector to project them, which I donated several years ago. In any case, this was generally speaking a group of about 30 students and me wandering around the campus. I remember I started out always with trees because that was more familiar to most of the students than shrubs and vines. And so the plant I always started out with was a gorgeous American elm. It's still there, next to the biochemistry building.
Oh, that big tree,
yes,
right?
Yes.
Almost it was what from Babcock.
Yes, yes. So it's we gathered around that tree, and I talked about why it was planted almost exclusively as a street tree in our municipalities. And then I talked about why. And then I started introducing the alternatives to that tree that are useful now as landscape and street trees. So I think always I had at least one TA. So the TA had another section at the same time, another 30 students. I alternated the two sections.
So
they had me every other time.
I see.
Then in the 70s, it was three sections. And so I had two TAs, and I alternated among the three.
Ed, did you have the three sessions? Does this relate to what you said on Monday about the thousands of flower children?
Yes, yes. That's where the enrollment in horticulture peaked, and I was killing myself teaching at that time because of the numbers we were dealing with. Those, by the way, I taught those two courses every solitary year for 33 years. I never took a sabbatical. I couldn't leave my plants for a year. There's no one else to back me up to teach my courses.
Did you teach those courses both semesters or just in the fall?
Well, one was a continuation of the other.
I see.
So the beginning of the semester, a second semester, was primarily lecture. And then as we were able to go outside, you can see it isn't in February that we could do that. But when we eventually did, then we would go back into the field.
Ed, you made a reference a few minutes ago to some of your best students were art majors. What explains that? How does that come to be?
I don't know, except they evidently just got turned on by this something that they hadn't encountered before. And they were serious about it.
Now, so, but before the early 70s and the big upsurge, who were the outlying students who came in, you know, who were not in horticulture or botany per se?
Well, a number of fields in the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences had a science requirement. And they had a number of possibilities, and my courses were among them.
Uh-huh.
So that was an elective in their cases.
I'm interested in vines.
So am I.
How did you get into vines, and what did you teach about it, and what is the issue there? I think vines are very interesting.
Well, you know, now we talk about vertical gardening, where space is tight. And so vines are, of course, exactly what we're talking about. Things like clematis, there's been an enormous explosion mm-hmm. In the cultivars that are available.
Mm-hmm.
But as I think of teaching vines, there was a fence between South Hall and the law building. It's probably long gone, but it's just a fence. I don't know why. I think it's because there was a fairly precipitous drop beyond that. And so Bill Longenecker had planted on that fence sweet autumn clematis, which smothered the whole area with fragrant white flowers in September. And of course, that's exactly when I was teaching, where it was so spectacular. There's a second vine on that fence that was also special. Right now it escapes me. And then, of course, on our horticulture building on the north side of it was this gorgeous Boston ivy that would turn brilliant red in the fall. So there again, teaching that in the fall was a natural. And we would I had my eye on some bittersweet vines in various places, including out here, and so we didn't have as good a vine collection out here. We still don't, as there are quite a few on the campus, interestingly, including that. And I just noticed in one of the university publications that this big chimney on the Ag Bulletin building is being repaired. It's a gorgeous chimney. It's next to the soils building. And,
it's down there.
So that was evidently the first heating plant. It's a gorgeous chimney. Why they're keeping it? Well, I'm glad they are and spending money on it. But that was covered with another vine, Parthenocissus virginiana, which is so brilliant. There are none on it now, I noticed from the picture.
Vines strike me as essentially artistic.
Well, they are. And they're, you know, most people know all about trees. A little bit about shrubs, but vines, I guess, may come as a surprise to people.
Yeah. wishing I had taken a course from you.
All right. That reminds me of one, though. Probably you never knew the Vilas house at the end of Langdon Street, where there is a big insurance company now.
It was
a gorgeous mansion. Why it was ever torn down, I'll never know. But on the north side of that building was a climbing hydrangea. It was the first one I had ever known in my life.
Oh, I didn't know that existed.
And it was up to the top. It was a three-story building. It was just so spectacular. And so I taught it, not there, but in other places ever since. But I think that was probably the first one I had ever seen.
Oh, yeah, and I know right where that insurance company is.
Yes.
I didn't realize there had been a house there. Yeah,
if you go to Kennedy Manor Dining Room, you park over there.
Yes, exactly right. Exactly right.
And then back, we're getting distracted. Back to my courses. In alternate years, I taught a course on the production and maintenance of landscape plants. And it was lecture and lab. I had the lab on Friday afternoon, which enabled us to take a fair number of field trips. And we came out here for a pruning lab. And I'm sure we came out here for other reasons too, but we went to McKay Nursery, we went to Young's in Randolph, we went to the Evergreen Nursery in Sturgeon Bay. And by the way, that trip was always an overnight. And I stayed at a motel. The students stayed at the experiment station, sleeping on the floor. And so not only did we have our field trip to Evergreen Nursery, but I took them to my favorite natural areas in Door County. And the students still talk about those trips. And one of the students in the course, their family had a place up there. So they invited us all over in an evening. We all sat around a big bonfire. That's where I could really relate to the students, mainly because of this sort of informality of walking around campus or being on field trips.
There's not the physical barrier of the podium and the front of the
yes,
room.
Yes. And I remember also one other time we returned from a field trip, and one of the students was from Columbus. And so he invited the whole group to their home for dinner on our way back to Madison. Mm-hmm. And I remember Jim Will was the student. My TA at the time was Mike Schneider, and Jim was one of these people who was a gourmet, and he considered Mike Schneider not to know anything about food. So he came out with a tray for Mike with Twinkies, bologna sandwich, and I forgot what else. I'll never forget it.
Before I let you go, what are some of the areas of Door County that are so extraordinary?
Well, I think I always took them to Toff Point. Now, Toff Point is owned by the university, but there's a gate. You can't drive all the way in. So it means driving into the gate and then walking maybe a mile, I don't know, something like that. And so, and Betty and I just went there last year again.
Oh.
Well, I still could walk. I was using, I don't think I had a cane yet then. But Toff Point is just a wonderful spot that that was donated. Well, the Nature Conservancy actually bought it from Emma Toft, the last member of the family, at a much reduced price, I know. And so that was always a very special place to go take the students.
Is that on the bay or the lake side?
It's on Moonlight Bay, and so it's, yeah, it's on the lake side, but it's a bay in Lake Michigan. And I'm sure we always went to Whitefish Bay. Mm-hmm. We didn't go into northern part of the county at all. I think we often went to a fish boil.
Oh.
So that was a very popular trip, of course. This was every other year.
Oh, I see.
So students typically took it as either a junior or a senior.
Now, I want to return to the fact that you taught this, the other course, for 33 years. That's quite extraordinary.
Thinking back at it, I wonder, how did I manage to do that?
And how did you do it without getting bored? I'm assuming you
were. I didn't. Betty used to say, aren't you tired of doing this? I said, no, I'm not. Mm-hmm. Betty didn't find teaching as exciting as I did. She was more in the writer, the researcher, that was more her focus.
And what is it in your mind that is exciting about teaching? When you say you found it exciting,
well,
what does that mean?
I guess I loved sharing my enthusiasms. You know, I was into this in a big way,
yes.
And this is what I was talking about, teaching.
And I suppose that as I think back to my enthusiastic teachers, it is infectious, isn't it?
I'm sure it is. And I felt the commitment. I had all these majors who needed these courses to graduate, and I didn't have a backup. Only once, when I was coming up for tenure, remember the chair of the department, Buck Gommelman, said, we better relieve you a little bit so you know you can pull some of this stuff together. So that one time I didn't teach the production maintenance course. And so that went for 2 years without being taught.
Maybe this is a good time to segue over into
I'm sorry. And then I was the person who taught undergraduate seminar endlessly. That was in the second semester.
You did that?
Yes.
And was that an honors course?
We didn't have honors in our college, it was a senior seminar, and they all had to take it.
Oh, it was required?
Yes.
They weren't invited to participate?
No, no.
And what was the content?
I left it fairly open. I gave them a list of suggestions, like a one-page list of topics they might consider. And they typically chose one of those. I can remember one student who talked about important plant explorers. She dressed up like one of them. And I remember another student talked about ginkgo tree. She brought in the ginkgo fruits for us to eat, which were sort of disgusting to me. But so it was. So that was one credit seminar that I taught for too many years.
I would think that would be satisfying in a way, because if they're seniors, they're more mature than some of the freshmen and sophomores, and might even have some interesting observations to make.
That's right. I must say, I always enjoyed the older students more than the younger. Mm-hmm. Those who had some life experiences, who knew where they were going, definitely. Mm-hmm.
Now, your resume shows that you have not only one, but two distinguished teaching awards. What can you tell me about that? Were you surprised when you got those? What did
well,
it mean to you?
Maybe I should be looking at them. First one I received was through the L.C. Chad. The first one is actually a college excellence in teaching award. That was in 1974. And I think I also received one as an advisor award from the college. I know I did. Yeah, I've got that right here, 1982. And then the L.C. Chadwick Award from the American Association of Nurserymen. That's a real prestigious national award that somebody nominated me for it. And so that was, you know, that was in 79. That was fairly early. So I was overwhelmed by it, really. That was one of a very important award. Then from the University of Wisconsin Distinguished Teaching Award in 1987, that was one of about, in those days, about four of us.
Yeah.
And we got all written up.
Yeah, that's pretty heavy duty. I mean, to be selected from that,
whole
university,
part of these teaching awards was my approach to teaching outside, which is quite unusual, and probably some other things too. And then the Arthur Hoyt Scott Medal, that was in 1996. That is at Swarthmore College. And they make a big deal out of it. And I got a medal, and I think $2,000. My family was all invited to it. They invited all my former students from the East.
Oh, really?
To come to it. And I had to give a lecture as part of it.
Who was Arthur Scott?
Scott Paper Company. And he was
an
alumnus of Swarthmore College. And so he was the founder of that award.
Wow. Oh, that is something.
Yeah, so it is. It's special. And, of course, I got one from the Chicago Botanic Garden and also from the AABGA, the American Association of Botanic Gardens and Arboreta. And from the Garden Club of America, the most recent one I got. The Liberty Hyde Bailey Award from the American Horticulture Society. That's a biggie also. So, but I think the more recent ones I received, I was nominated by former students. I know I was, at least in one or two of those cases. Couple of them got together and did it.
That has to be very satisfying.
So that was important. Yes.
And all of the teaching awards that you received had to have been confirmation of your decision to focus so much energy on teaching.
Yes. I'm sure it did. And so you want to be recognized, obviously, for your efforts.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right.
It's important. And we want to turn now to a review of your graduate students, all of those who received masters under your direction, and what you can tell me about them, who they are, and how it is that they are significant today.
I'm going back to 1966 and up through when I retired in 1994. And I have the list in front of me, and I'll just make a comment on a few of them. Daryl Apps, the name may sound a little bit familiar because Jerry Apps is his brother.
Oh, his brother.
Yes, Jerry is the older brother of Daryl Apps. Daryl Apps spent most of his career at Longwood Gardens in Pennsylvania as the director of education at this fabulous garden. He actually went on, he also taught at Penn State and at the University of Kentucky, and he is now retired back in Wisconsin in his hometown of Wild Rose. But later in his career, he became a very well-known breeder of daylilies and introduced some of the still some of the best daylilies in the industry.
Are you still in touch with him?
Oh yes, I saw him a couple months ago. Bruce Rigby came to me from England as a graduate student, and after getting his master's degree with me, got his PhD with Mac Dana, and returned to England and had a long teaching career at Askham Bryan College in Yorkshire. He is now retired. Lee Hansen made a real name for himself as being the horticultural agent in Milwaukee County, especially working with the disadvantaged. And Lee was the sort of person who could work with anyone and was so good at it. Well, then he got his wife was the daughter of a prominent greenhouse owner in Green Bay. He got talked to going back and joining the family. But then ultimately he taught at the be the Northeast the college in Green Bay, the vocational school. I think it's Northeast NE Vocational School. He is now retired. Larry Marty, in a long teaching career at Kishwaukee College in Illinois, now retired to Wisconsin. Mike Schneider is now the director of the what's the center up at Ellison Bay, Wisconsin? The
I
can't say it. We'll have to come back and correct that, because that is a very special place, and he's doing a super job there. I had
is
a,
that
a
the clearing.
The clearing, yes. Mike Schneider is the director of the clearing.
That's a beautiful spot.
It is, and we always visit him whenever we get up there.
Is his taste in food any better?
Maybe so. His twin children are now on campus. Matusum Meki was from the Sudan. He was the only real non-native kind of student I ever had. And he was the first person with a degree in landscape architecture in his country. Huh. I always called him Meki because everybody else did too, his last name. And he later became the agricultural attaché to the Netherlands. That's probably my most interesting former student.
Are you still in touch with him?
I haven't in recent years. Bill Thomas is the director of Chanticleer, a private garden in the Philadelphia area, which almost everyone would name as their favorite garden in America.
Really?
Not only that, but Bill Thomas has been one of the major contributors to the Longenecker Gardens Endowment. And
wonderful.
He's one of these people who nominated me, I know, for the Scott Award.
Where is the Chanticleer Garden? Is it open to the public?
Oh, yes. It's a must-see, absolutely. It's gorgeous.
In the city or in the
No,
suburbs?
It's in one of the suburbs. It's just a must-see, really. He spent the early part of his career at Longwood Gardens.
I see.
Peter Gallagher went on to get his PhD at Ohio State and taught through his entire career at Louisiana Tech. He is just retired. And his son just has run for treasurer of Dane County. And I voted for him. Gary Kling got his PhD at Illinois, University of Illinois, where he has been teaching my courses ever since.
Has he ever invited you down to guest lecture?
No. But I see him at meetings occasionally. Dick Rideout, whose father was a professor of English, Dick is from Madison.
Yeah.
He is the head of urban forestry with DNR. And probably is the best writer of any of my former students. And guess where he got it? From his father, English professor. Glenn Harold also taught at Central Illinois College in Peoria, retired, I think, now 2 years ago, and has moved back to Wisconsin. Ray Rogers is now teaching at a technical college up in Sheboygan County. After having been in the Philadelphia area for years, where he was an editor for one of the publishing companies, and his brother lives in Sheboygan. I think this induced him to come back here. And that's only this last year. Chris Bochtel, this is 1980 now, Chris has only position has always been with the Morton Arboretum. He is now director of collections. Probably the top, certainly the top horticulturist there. And he's gone on plant exploration trips to China, I don't know how many times, Russia, and so he's had a very interesting career. Jeff Epping is the director of horticulture at Oldbrook. And I couldn't be more proud of any former student than I am of him.
Really? Why do you
say that? He's a guy who had a stuttering problem as an undergrad. I literally forced him to take speech. He is one of the best speakers in the country right now. He is a guy that had no formal training in design. He is just incredible. He's so talented. So, where some of this comes from, it's hard to say. Kate Jerome, another one. She's teaching at Gateway Technical College in Kenosha.
You spawned a lot of teachers.
Yes. Michelle Eggers her husband, she married a person from the department, and he is a cranberry expert, and they have a cranberry company now. But Michelle came back to the campus last year to teach one of the courses in our department. And of course, she was so indebted to me for writing a nice letter of recommendation. And so, I could go on and on about many of the others. I guess some of the undergraduates who have gone on to great things. I think of Bill Radler, who was a graduate in landscape architecture. He turned into being a rose breeder. He developed the top-selling rose in America, I'll have to come back and revise some of these things. He's in the Milwaukee area, and it's now he's got a whole series of roses, and they are just fabulous. He's a millionaire many times over. Certainly the most successful former student financially that I had. There are others who of my undergraduates who I pushed to go on to graduate school. And so there are a number of those who went on to other places and got their PhDs.
And what was the master's program like? Was it a one-year, two-year program? Did they have to write a thesis? Or
it was typically about a year and a half. No one, I don't think, ever finished in a year. But mostly a non-thesis, although a paper that could be published was often the requirement. And so if you look at the list of publications, a lot of those are that.
Uh-huh.
And maybe I should turn to some of those right now if you want me to.
Yes, we were going to do a section on publications, so this would be a good time.
Well, the person I just mentioned, Chris Bochtel, who's at the Morton Arboretum, we did a study of a shrub called Potentilla fruticosa, of which there are many cultivars. And we did much of the work at the Minnesota Landscape Arboretum, where they had an excellent collection along with ours here. So it meant a lot of travel up there. And this was published in the American Nurseryman, where we published most of our papers. And it is still considered the foremost treatment of that group of plants today. And I was just going to go back and see what year that was published. I'll get there. Got to turn the page. That was 1982.
Okay.
And so what I typically did for graduate students is I would accumulate a planting of cultivars and selections of a particular genus. And then once they achieved some maturity, I worked with a student on evaluating of that group of plants. Now, obviously, we had an important crabapple collection, so that we didn't have to do any accumulation, really. But as I look down here, Oh, and I guess early on in my career, I was definitely into junipers. And we talked about, I introduced two different junipers.
Right.
So Mike Schneider did his paper on the evaluation of ground cover junipers, which we published in the American Nurseryman. This next paper, introducing the white spire birch, we talked about that as an important plant introduction.
Where was that published?
That was in Arnoldia. That's the journal of the Arnold Arboretum in Massachusetts.
And which of these journals, you know, would be like Lancet or JAMA is for the medical community?
These are very specifically aimed at woody plants.
Okay.
And so anyone who's looking for the most up-to-date, at least in those years, the American Nurseryman was an important one. Crab apple. Well, there's one on crab apples down here with Bruce Cubberly, another master student, did an evaluation of amelanchier. This is a native small flowering tree. And out of that grew one of my introductions of the of an amelanchier. Jeff Epping, who I mentioned, did his thesis work on shrub roses, which he has really continued on with at Olbrich ever since. You checked 56 years of lilacs here. That doesn't relate to a student. Here's another student, David Guthrie, did one on ornamental crab apples, which was a very important contribution.
Why was that important?
Because I'm considered the crabapple expert in the country.
Really?
And still am.
Also
amelanchier, actually.
Do you still work in that realm? I mean, do you make
I haven't gone digital, and so I really needed an excuse to say no when someone asked me to speak. And so the last talk I gave, real significant talk, was about 2 years ago at the 50th anniversary of Johnson's Nursery in the Milwaukee area. And they invited the Wisconsin Landscape Contractors Association to this meeting. And as the person in charge said, well, usually at this meeting, only about 50 people come. There are about 150, and they're almost all former students. And of course, I got a standing ovation.
How wonderful.
On that occasion. Michelle Eggers did the winterberries, Ilex verticillata. There we stepped on somebody's toes, a nurseryman who had introduced one which we didn't rate well, and I've always felt badly about that because he was a friend, and sometimes you do that, which is hard. Then one of these papers in here with Glenn. Well, I also have been interested in the American chestnut in Wisconsin. And so with two different graduate students, we really mapped the American chestnuts that exist in the state of Wisconsin.
Are they all over the state?
The one is up at Bayfield, and they're locally, so pretty much all over the state, scattered. Not huge numbers, and you know, the American chestnut in its natural range was lost to the chestnut blight.
And when was that blight?
In the 1910s.
Okay.
And eliminated in its natural range, which did not include Wisconsin. But the interesting part of the story is that people who came to Wisconsin from New England, from New York State, let's say in the 1870s, 1880s, often brought the chestnuts with them and planted them on their new farm in Wisconsin. They were mainly Yankees. And so there's one farm that is especially interesting. It's the Einar Lundy farm. Does he sound Norwegian to you? Mm-hmm. And on that farm, it's his farm. It's probably a previous owner who brought the chestnuts there. But there are 33 of them in a row with trunks like this.
Wow.
And they have naturalized in the area around those trees. And there's another site near Wisconsin Dells and here in Madison. John Curtis told me about one of them in Madison. John said, there's one on Few Street in Madison. This is of Curtis Prairie, John Curtis. And so it was for years that I finally found it. And it's still there. I could show it to you. And so in any case, there are scattered ones where there's a single one. They're infertile. They need cross-pollination.
Oh.
And so the individual ones will never reproduce. But the upshot of the story really is that the natural range came into Michigan because of the prevailing westerly winds and the physical separation of Lake Michigan. The blight never got to Wisconsin. And so we have these incredible trees yet where it's been wiped out in throughout its whole natural range.
So are they protected in any way? I mean, legally?
No, they are not. And so, fortunately, they're still blight-free. So we did a paper for the Wisconsin Academy, and that keeps popping up every so often. I hear from people about it. There have been several people who've been really interested in American chestnuts that have gotten in touch with me. But we have four mature ones out here in the Longenecker that were grown from seed from the Einar Lundy farm. But they were presented to Bill Longenecker by the director of the Forest Products Lab. And these were growing in the nursery here when I came, and I planted those out.
Ed, is the American chestnut a particularly attractive tree?
Well, it's much like a red oak. It looks a little bit like a red oak. So it's a bit coarse, but you know, if you read about it in the literature, here's a tree that provided the food for people and for wildlife. The timber, split rail fences were always American chestnut.
Really?
Because it is so durable, it doesn't rot, and then shade. So people always talked about the three wonderful uses of the American chestnut.
My grandparents lived in Salem, Oregon, and I remember they had a small house in the city, but as I recall, there was a huge chestnut tree in front of it.
Uh-huh.
I used to get sent out to pick up chestnuts, which I thought was great.
Yes.
So
now they may have been Spanish chestnuts or Chinese chestnuts, which would be hardy there. Although they could be American chestnuts because they were planted out there like they were in Wisconsin.
Well, that side of the family comes from Michigan.
So that explains it.
You know, so I was interested to hear you say that.
Yes.
And when you say that you developed a particular interest in the American chestnut, and I think there are others growing things that you said that about, how is it that a horticulturist chooses what really interests them? What was it about the American chestnut and the crabapple, for that matter, that compelled your attention?
I guess I'll jump back to the creeping juniper, Juniperus horizontalis. It's a plant that is rare in Wisconsin and occurs on two very specific habitats: the sand dunes of Lake Michigan or sandstone bluffs elsewhere in Wisconsin.
Yes.
So I'm intrigued by that habitat, by a plant like in this case. Most of them turn an ugly brown in winter, where the occasional one turns a beautiful purple or blue. Mm-hmm. And so you're intrigued by that one plant in a million or a thousand that is out there. And I guess getting back also to the American chestnut, I don't know if we mentioned Walter Scott or not. Walter Scott was originally with the Conservation Commission in Wisconsin. He was a secretary of the Wisconsin Conservation Commission or whatever, which became the DNR.
Oh. Okay.
And his career extended into the DNR period. But Walter was interested in finding the largest tree of each kind in the state of Wisconsin. He enlisted me in this. Yes, there's some mention of that in there. And so for years, I was the keeper of, well, Walter kept those records. And he, like Bill Longenecker, turned that over to me. Walter was a very close friend. And he also, before he died, gave me some very valuable books from his library. And so, he had a big influence on me too. And so Walter, he measured every oak over a certain size in much of Dane County. I think that was after he retired. And I sort of did this as I traveled the state with Extension. If I knew there was a tree that I should measure in a certain area, I think of one in Green Bay. It's in the city. A smoke tree that is the most extraordinarily large plant. And so I'd measure it when it was convenient. And then a lot of my students got turned onto this. And a number of some of the extension agents. One, Paul Hartman, was a hort agent in Brown County, and did one for the did a publication on the largest trees in Brown County. And so I guess that sort of got me going on the American chestnut, finding those and measuring them. And Walter had done all the background work on it.
So are those trees identified anecdotally? Would someone say, well, you know, Professor, there's a really big oak tree down the block?
Well, actually, going back to the Walter Scott's big tree record, that was published several times over the years. It No, it isn't being continued to any great. Dick Rideout took the responsibility from me, and so it's a low priority for most people, unfortunately.
That's too bad.
It is, because, by the way, Michigan has more state champion trees than any other state.
Really?
Why? Because they're so interested. There are all these people working on it. So the largest white pine in the country was in Wisconsin. That's gone now, I think.
Oh.
The largest, it was typically the native ones, of course, which really got big. The biggest white spruce was in Wisconsin. Here in the Longenecker Gardens, for a while, we had the largest blue ash.
Oh.
Again, because it's pretty rare. And that got removed when the parking lot went in. We now have the largest sunburst honey locust in the state, here right in the Longenecker Gardens. And there are a couple others, mainly because they're unusual trees and very few have been planted in the state of Wisconsin.
Has the largest oak in the state been identified?
I'm sure it has, of each kind. And the largest one is probably a bur oak. I could look it up. But the largest tree in the state is a cottonwood.
Really?
Which is somewhere near Columbus. It's like this. Well, they get huge.
But I didn't think they were very sturdy.
Well, they're not, but they're fast growing and they do get big. And so Bruce Allison did one of the, published one of the reports on the biggest trees in Wisconsin. And on the cover, he has a picture of that tree. Standing next to it is the farmer who owns it, who is almost as big as the tree around. It's just a wonderful photo. So I was always intrigued by this project of Walter Scott's, and I thought at one time, now when I retire, I'm going to do that. But of course, there are many other more important things that came along. I haven't done it.
And I'd like now to turn to your career as a member of the UW Extension. And you were there from almost the beginning, as I recall. It was essentially a 50-50 appointment between the department and the Extension. And I know we touched on it somewhat on Monday, but if you could talk about what your role really was, and what you were expected to do, and what some of the challenges were from that position, and how were you received out in the state as a representative of the Extension, particularly in those earlier days, the 60s and 70s?
Work in Extension, basically we had a commitment to every county in the state, but only a relative, let's say about six counties perhaps, had horticultural agents. And so we worked primarily with horticultural agents, although agricultural agents or agents of other specialties certainly called on us at times. And so a lot of it was through correspondence, phone calls, in other words, supporting these county people with our expertise. And of course, mine was, as we know, woody plants, landscape plants, and so on. And so often there were a whole series of meetings throughout the state.